So I'm from England, as I guess most of you know, and one of my memories of England is watching TV as a kid, and one of the TV programs I remember watching as a kid on a black and white TV, so we're talking about ancient history here, is a TV show called Colditz. And Colditz was a TV series about the Second World War, and the Nazis had taken a castle. It's based on historical reality, to tell you the truth. And they turned it into a POW camp, and this TV show was all about trying to escape from Colditz, trying to escape from this captivity. And then I came to Canada, and lo and behold, there's more stories about escape. And one of my favorite TV shows when I was a kid in junior high was Hogan's Heroes. Man, there you go again, you know, there's a story there of people trying to escape captivity. And I got thinking as I was talking and reading today's lesson and the stuff that we're supposed to be working our way through about how popular it is to have TV shows or movies or whatever that have to do with escape from captivity and freedom. Do any of you have any that, you know, a movie you watched or a TV show that... Netflix or anything? Anyone? No, you don't watch those type things. You just read your Bible the whole time. You don't watch movies. You don't go to TV and nothing like that.
Prison Break.
Prison Break.
There you go.
All kinds of these. Now tell you what I think. I think it's because this whole theme of moving from captivity to freedom is something that God puts into our hearts. Because he wants to move us all from captivity, all kinds of things, into freedom. And we're going along in this story-form way, as Jason said. And today, to tell you the truth, tonight's a real challenge. Because we're trying to follow this curriculum. And the curriculum is like, there are 2.5-hour lessons, and I'm supposed to do it in 20 minutes. But we'll give it a shot, okay? So today we're going to talk about the next stage. So we've all talked about creation, and we talked about Noah. And we talked about the establishment of covenants, and last week Ryan talked about Abram, who became Abraham, and then Abraham, he had a son whose name was Isaac, and Isaac had a son whose name was Jacob, and Jacob's name got changed to Israel, okay? And that's because the name Israel means wrestled with God. And so Jacob had this wrestle with God, and he changed the name to Israel, and Jacob had 12 sons, right? And those 12 sons became the fathers of what? Anyone know? 12 of them. Name was Israel. 12 tribes of Israel, right? And so their descendants became the 12 tribes of Israel. And one of his sons, named Joseph, it's got just an incredible story, and sometime you should read it, or maybe have to check it out sometime. But he ended up in Egypt, you remember. First he was in prison, always kind of slave, and then he was in prison. And then he ended up being second only to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And there was a big famine came across the land. And remember the whole deal, he brought his whole family to Egypt. And at first they got kind of special treatment. But then a Pharaoh that didn't know Joseph, he came to rule and he gave him some special treatment as well. He was terrified of him. He said, these Hebrew people, they're so numerous, they could rise up against us and slaughter us all. And so what we need to do is we need to enslave them. And that slavery in Egypt, that captivity, lasted 400 years. And so there they were, they ended up in enslavery. That's an Egyptian picture to kind of, you know, some people say that it didn't really happen, but there's archaeological evidence to show that it did. Duff can give you the lowdown on that if you ever want to talk to him about it, he's doing all that kind of stuff. And so they're in slavery for 400 years, and they had to make bricks to build pyramids, and then Pharaoh took the straw away and said, you've got to build the bricks anyhow, get your own straw and all those things. But God gave his people a promise. The promise that they would, in fact, be given freedom. And it started off on this whole deal where Pharaoh said these people are still numerous and what needs to happen is that all of the baby boys need to be killed. And so Moses' mom hid her in the bulrushes, that whole kind of deal. And you remember that Pharaoh's daughter came and found Moses. And so Moses grew up in Pharaoh's household. And he grew up learning all what it meant about leadership and how to run government and all of these kinds of things and became a very, very powerful man. But in his heart, he knew that God had something for him for his own people, the Hebrew people, because his family kind of kept in touch there a little bit. And one day, Moses kind of does a false start. He thought and believed that he could be a bit of a deliverer, and he saw an Egyptian beating a fellow Hebrew, and so Moses killed him and buried him in the sand. But he got caught anyhow, and so he had to take off running, and he spent a pile of years in the wilderness learning how to live in the wilderness and how to be not just a ruler, but a shepherd. Not just a leader through authority and structure, but through pastoral, loving and caring for sheep. And then he had the big event of meeting the burning bush. Saw off in the distance the bush that burned, but it never burned up. It was on fire, so he went up and God said, you know, take off your sandals, the holy ground. And he said, I'm going to send you back to Egypt, to Pharaoh, and you're going to set my people free. And Moses is like, I already tried that. I'm scared. And so God said, no, I'm going to give you a staff in your hand that's going to cause all kinds of miracles, and your brother Aaron's going to speak to you because you say you're a lousy talker, all these kind of things. And so Moses went back to Egypt and said to Pharaoh, you've got to let God's people go. You can no longer have them as slaves. And Pharaoh said, not a chance. And so he had to be forced. And so the way in which God did that is through what we know as the 10 plagues. You know what? Really, a better translation of the word is 10 blows, like 10 strikes. It's like God holds up Pharaoh, and more importantly, or equally important, all the Egyptian god, and one, two, just pounds every god that Egypt had. And so these plagues, they sort of run in three sets of three and one very special one. The first plague was blood, frogs, gnats, and lice. The land was covered with them. What's interesting about this whole deal is that the magicians of Egypt could also turn water into blood and cause frogs to fill the land. Now, it's kind of a weird thing, and for a long time I wondered, what in the world is that all about that these magicians can do? And I'll tell you what it is they did that in the power of sin. You see, we must never forget as Christians that our enemy does in fact have some power. I mean, it's trickery and it's treachery and it's lies and all these different things, but we're in this battle against a foe who actually has some power, but he could not bring up gnats or lice. It's a bit of a debate as to what came up with these flying gnats or lice that filled the people. Whatever it was, they were little blood-sucking animals that flooded and covered over the land of Egypt, and the magicians couldn't do that. And that was the first step of the defeat of the gods. Because you see, each one of these plagues stood for one of the good gods of Egypt. They had a fertility god that was symbolized by a frog. So this is God taking on everything. And then when the priests of Egypt couldn't do what Yahweh did, that was God saying, I am present in the land of places that you think are other gods. I am present and I am more powerful. I am powerfully present in your life. No matter what goes on, no matter how much the enemy wants to trick and deceive you. The next ones were a plague of flies, a plague of livestock, and boils. This poor fellow here has some of those that boiled, some of those are tumors with this condition that he has. And the deal with this whole strike against God was that not only did the magicians and the false priests of these false gods raise up this kind of illness, but they were afflicted themselves with boils, and they were so embarrassed and kind of so ugly and so messed up and so disfigured that they were afraid to appear before Pharaoh. And so this is God once again showing that I am more powerful than all of these gods, the gods that are represented by flies, the gods that you think are providing and caring for your livestock. I'm going to wipe out your livestock. All of these different things. And then Pharaoh, though still remained stubborn, still refused to let his people go. So the next series came along, and it was the plague of hail, locusts, and darkness. You see what I did there, baby? This is a major deal, and here's why. The major Egyptian god was Ra, and he was what? Guess what? He was the sun god, right? He's the one that they gave credit to give the land, the sunshine, and the warmth, and all those things. And Pharaoh was elevated to the point of the son of Ra. Okay? Now, if we go into a little bit of the history there, you look at the book of the Egyptian, the book of the dead, we read this about Ra. I am he who, among the gods who cannot be repulsed, who can't be pushed back, who can't be withheld. I'm that kind of God. Who is he? He is Ra, and when he arises on the eastern horizon of heaven, he can't be pushed back. And so what does God do? God takes the most high Egyptian God. God takes the God who Pharaoh is supposed to be the embodiment of, the person of, the one for, through whom all sunshine comes and all crops grow and all good things happen. And for 3 days, God repulses, pushes back, contains the Egyptian God of Ra. And he squishes all of the theology of the Egyptians with their elevation of their king into godhood into the ground. Because Yahweh is saying, I am God, not you. No wonder Pharaoh at this point was so angry he would no longer allow Moses to appear before him. Because before this, you remember, Moses would come and say, if you don't let my people go, this is going to happen. If you don't let my people go, this is going to happen. Moment of darkness. It was kind of like the ultimate insult. The insult put down, and he says, you must never appear before my face again. And Moses says, okay. But instead, there was one more plague. A terrible one. The death of the firstborn. But God said, all of your firstborn, from the lowest slave to the household of Pharaoh, all of the people, all of the animals, your firstborn will die. Unless you do this, unless you slaughter a lamb and you put it over the doorposts of your house, and if you will enter and dwell in that house when the angel of death goes through the land, he will pass over that house. Not just for the Hebrew people, though that's where it was centered, but any Egyptian who chose to believe that yes, in fact, Yahweh would do this, yes, in fact, Yahweh is the ultimate God, that crowded themselves into those Hebrew hovels and the slave places where they lived, all those people's families were spared as well. And this is the great Passover sacrifice and the feast called Passover, which is celebrated by the Jews even today, is settled in and grows out of this great miracle of God, where he squished all of the Egyptian gods and he humbled Pharaoh and he allowed his people to go free from slavery. I'm sure you remember the story that Moses tells his people. Pharaoh says, okay, you can go. And so Moses says, okay, we're going to go, but first you go to your Egyptian lords and you go to your Egyptian neighbors and you ask them for all their gold and all their silver and all of their stuff. And the wealth of Egypt, the most powerful nation, was given to these former slaves, and they escaped into the wilderness. Well, after a while, Pharaoh realizes, of course, that his entire economy is collapsing, all of his labor is going to be going, and he gathers his army, and he sets after the Hebrew people with Moses in the lead. And it's kind of a weird thing, because what God does is he leads his people all around the place, and he deliberately backs his people up against the Red Sea so that they're trapped. And then the Egyptian army comes to them. And the people begin to cry out, and Moses begins to cry out to God, why did you do this to us? And God says an incredibly interesting thing to Moses. He says, why are you crying out to me? Why are you sitting there praying when you should be taking action? Take your staff and hit the water, and boom, the Red Sea parts and the people go through. And then, of course, the Egyptian army tries to follow them. And they, that whole deal. And so they're in there, the chariots, and boom, in comes the Red Sea, and it wipes out the Egyptian army. And God's people are free from slavery. Because God is faithful to his covenant to Abraham. Now here's, imagine this. There you are, you've been a slave for generations. Your every waiting moment has been determined for you. The way in which you relate to other people is determined for you. Who you can marry, determined for you. How to raise children, determined for you. Where your children are, determined for you. And so all of a sudden, these slaves have to figure out how to live in freedom. It's a scary thing to live in freedom if you've been enslaved to something. And if you don't think it is, think about your own life and some things that have maybe took you captive. All kinds of us stay in situations that are bad for us and harmful for us and terrible for us because we're afraid of what freedom would bring. And so God has to help his people live in freedom. And so he gives the Ten Commandments and a whole bunch of commandments after that. This is the guide of God. If you want to live your life well, if you want to live in relationship with me well, if you want to live in relationship with other people well, then these are the foundational 10 words of my new covenant, of my covenant with you. And then he gives you a whole bunch of other rules and regulations and laws afterwards about how to dress and what to eat and what you can eat and how you can't eat and how to wash your hands and or everything that a slave would need to know how to live. Because all of a sudden they have to make decisions for themselves. And they have to learn how it is to live in freedom. And so these 10 commandments do a couple of things. Number one is they show the moral character of God. And if you look into those commandments and you look at what lies behind this, you can see all kinds of things about the nature and the character of God. But the second thing it does is it tells people to live well. But of course, people blow it. I blow it. You blow it. We all blow it. And so God had to design some way in which the people, when we break these covenants, when we break these commands, how is it that we can stay in good relationships with God? And so God established sacrifices. The one sacrifice we've already talked about, the sacrifice of Passover, where a lamb was slaughtered so that the angel of death passed over the people. And a Passover, that sacrifice continued to remind people that this is what God has done. But there was a second sacrifice. I mean, there's all kinds of sacrifices, but there's a second one that I want us to talk about. And that is the sacrifice of the Day of Atonement. And you can find out about it in Leviticus chapter 16. And on the Day of Atonement, two goats were selected. And goat number one had his throat cut. It was sacrificed for atonement. That's a really, really fancy word, atonement. Although this movie's called Atonement, and so it's a little, you know, a bit more modern. But you should be watching that movie, I don't think. But I've heard there's this movie. So, but the whole deal is that it's a sacrifice in payment for somebody else. And if you break the word up, it's at one meant. And the whole idea is that this sacrifice on the Day of Atonement made people and God at one with him again. That bridge, that gap that happens because of our rebellion, because of our sin, because of our failure to be faithful to the covenant, is brought back together through the sacrifice of atonement. And that's kind of a neat thing. But I'll tell you what's really cool is the second goat. Because the second goat, the priest would take the second goat, and he would lay his hands upon its head. And he would confess the sins of Israel. And then the goat would be given to a guy. And that guy would take that goat way out into the wilderness. And he'd let that goat free, carrying with it the sins of the nation for another year. And that goat is called a scapegoat. It carries the blame of other people. And this was how God brought his people from slavery in Egypt to freedom in his covenant and made sure that they could remain free through a series of sacrifices. Well, that's great, Al. It's a nice story, but what in the world has that got to do with us? How does this story fit with us? How does the story of God, how does that relate to us now? Well, I'll tell you how. It's because God is in the business of us escaping slavery in life. God is in the business of breaking the chains that hold us up. You see, we get ourselves into slavery. We don't mean to. I remember when I was in Bible college, I was actually... our Bible college had these teams, you know, and every couple, three times a year, you'd go to a different church and you'd do, you know, Sunday school and preach and music, all this kind of stuff. And so a team of us with a professor whose name was Gary Hammer, driving up to Grand Prairie, and ended up talking about sex. I remember the conversation well. And I remember one of the girls on the team, who lived kind of on the wild side for a while before she came to Christ, talked about how difficult it was in the spiritual life. And I remember Gary Hatt saying, nobody said that sin wasn't fun. You know, that word stuck with me quite a while. Because that's how sin starts out, isn't it? It starts out as fun. It starts out feeling good. We're satisfying some need. We're medicating some kind of pain. We're trying to deal with our shame. We're just, you know, having a good time. We're elevating ourselves above other people. We're being greedy and having the fruits of everybody else work for us. We're riding the wave of popularity by putting other people down. It starts out, it kind of feels good at first. But you see, that's the bait of Satan, isn't it? It starts out feeling good, but then pretty soon, those things that started out being fun, they begin to take over us. And they begin to enslave us. The Apostle Paul writes about that in Romans chapter 6. He says, look, don't you know that when you offer yourself to someone as obedient slaves, you're slaves to the one you obey, whether you're slave to sin, which leads to death, or to obedience, which leads to righteousness. Sin enslaves us. And we've all got different things that maybe start out kind of feeling good, but eventually enslave us. I'm a guy. So I wrestled for a lot of years with the big three. Pride, lust, and anger. I don't know too many men that don't wrestle with those things. And each of those things, they kind of start out feeling good. They start feeling good, you know, the whole pride about thinking that you're doing pretty good and being the best at this and the best at that and better than that guy at this and better than that guy at that. And it starts out feeling good, but pretty soon it leads to terrible loneliness. And lustful stuff, porn or whatever you want to do, rampant sexuality feels pretty good at first until you realize that you're dehumanizing other people. Until you realize that all of your relationships are shallow and they don't last longer than 3 or 4 months. And anger. At first it's good because, man, you get mad, people get out of the way. Stuff happens when we get mad. Stuff happens and it's good. Until you realize you're crushing other people's spirits. They've done the opposite to what we're supposed to be doing, which is build people up. So I don't know what your deal is that enslaves us. For some people, it's popularity. And it feels good to be known by all kinds of people until then you begin to realize that, you know what, I'm selling my soul to stay popular. I'm giving up all my values in order to be in with the popular people to get what I want. And for some people, maybe it's drugs. Starts out having a good time. Starts out just partying. Starts out just social. Starts out just relaxing. If it's, you know, prescription drugs, whatever. Starts out being just with friends, if it's alcohol, whatever it is, and all of a sudden it begins to enslave us and drag us down into addiction and into slavery to that, and crime and all kinds of bad stuff, and loss of relationship follows. And maybe it's porn, rampant in our society, it's so available on the internet, you can hardly escape it. Maybe it's money. It starts out, man, you get the big buck, get the bigger house, get the toys, get the this, and before we know it, it's become our God and it enslaves us, and we start to lose our money, we start to feel like we're losing ourselves, and we start to feel like we're losing our popularity, we start to feel like we're losing our wealth, and not only our wealth, but our worth. Maybe it's fear of losing something else. But Jason said in some things, quoting the guy, that, I think that's named Jeff Benito. That guy, I can't remember the last name. Took, like, Jones Smith is a good name. Vander or whatever, some Dutch thing. He said, you know, the thing is this, is that we have these things that we love. But when that thing becomes threatened, whatever threatens that thing has power over our life, becomes an idol in our life. Becomes something that we're terrified of, something that we fear, something that we serve and become a slave to. So we all get into this slavery, but thank God, the whole story of Exodus is a picture of how Jesus wants to bring us through our exit. Exodus means exit, like exit, get out. Okay, that Jesus wants to take us out of that. It's an incredible thing because, you see, Jesus is the sacrifice for our sin. He is the one that brings atonement, the one that pays the price for what destroys us, the one that makes us once again at one with God. That Jesus is in fact has become the scapegoat. That on Jesus, all of the sins of all of our life goes upon us. And he went outside of the city gates. You ever wonder about that in the Bible? You're reading that? Christ's crucifixion is outside of the city. That's Jesus taking all of the sins, your sin, my sin, everyone's sin, out of the city to die for them and to take it away. Jesus is in fact the Passover lamb who was slain. And his lifeblood causes death to pass over us. And he invites us, once we're out of this slavery, to live the free life. He tells us how to live in covenant, and that's what that Sermon on the Mount's all about, it, how to live in covenant with God. But what's more important than that, I think, almost, is this. He gives us his Holy Spirit to dwell within us, so that we can begin to be faithful to covenant, so that we can begin to live the life of Christ. So that we can begin to live the lives of freedom and joy that God intended us to live all along. He empowers you to be free from whatever it is that tries to enslave you. Through Jesus Christ and the living presence of God in the Holy Spirit. So we're going to do a little deal here. Jason's going to come and we're going to sing a song, No Longer Slaves. You know this song. And here's what we want to offer you. If you